All right, so this evening we're going to cover the background of 1 Corinthians. So I had some maps on my iPad and they were all dressed up and nice and everything, and that is not wanting to work, so we're going to use my phone and we'll just see how that works. But I think it'd be important for us to see what and where Corinth is and a little bit more about it. I think it's important for us to understand the landscape of that time, including, you know, regions, notable cities, you know, the economy, nationalities, religions, and stuff like that. And so I want to start there. Wally, I'm using my phone, so I'm not recording. Do we need another phone up here? We're good? Okay. Okay, so I want to start with, not that. I want to start with this view of the region. Okay, so I'm going to click back in here. So this is the region of Greece. You know, we're talking Europe. Let me see if I can't. I got fat fingers, so bear with me. Okay, so this is Europe. Corinth is going to be somewhere right in there. All right. Corinth is under Roman government or under Roman control in the first century. As far as regions go, let's see if I can. It's not that. Regions go. This area here would be considered Achaia. Up this way is Epirus, I think is how you say it. Macedonia is going to come around somewhere like this. It's good for us to know because, and hopefully y'all can see that. It's good for us to know because Corinth isn't always referenced as Corinth. It's referenced as Achaia, and Achaia is a region, but they are used synonymously. Same thing as Philippi with Macedonia. There are other cities that are in Macedonia, but Philippi was the one that was synonymous with Macedonia. So I'm going to put a little M here. And a little A there. Those are the regions. Now, I want us to understand that because as we go through, we're going to look at, hopefully, with the way this is going to work out, I want to look at Paul's missionary journey and some of the cities around it as it's going to pertain to Paul and his journey and then making it to Corinth. If you zoom in here a little closer, this is Corinth right here. If you'll notice, Corinth is what they call an isthmus. All right, so it is a small land bridge between two larger areas. Okay, because of its location, it was a very strategic commercial area. You see here that it would allow for people to access the Gulf of Corinth. It also allowed them, if you go back to the other, to access this great body of water, the Aegean Sea, off of Greece. It also would allow travel into Asia. It would allow travel up into Europe. It would travel over into what is the capital of Rome. Hopefully, I'm not drawing anything, but that's what that would be. Also coming in from south, you've got Egypt. Now, when you look at this, it's not in modern day times where we can just travel hundreds of miles at a time easily over a short period of time. They needed to travel near land and during certain seasons because of weather. But this made Corinth a great port area. This isthmus here, where Corinth is at, is not very far across, about a 2-hour walk. And so Corinth actually spanned not the entire area, but was in that time, about 90,000 people. I think it said 400 BC was about 90,000 strong. So you could equate that maybe to about the time of Christ. But being a strategic port area, you could go from one side to the other with very little land crossing. And so it made it a very important place. Now, with the strategic commercial area that it's in, it also meant lots of people traveled through that area. So you're going to have a lot of nationalities, a lot of different religions. You're going to have a lot of political ideology. You're going to have a lot of things going on. Not to mention that it were not that far from Athens, which was at one point the capital of the Greek nation before the Romans took over. Athens was a very large city at that period of time. Athens also was full of free thinkers, philosophers, many religions and stuff like that. Corinth in the time of Christ was also a senatorial province. So you'll notice in Acts chapter 18, and we'll get to it in a little bit, but Acts chapter 18, it mentions Gallio as the proconsul. So again, an important place. It's also one of your anchor points if you're trying to figure out times and dates in Acts. I think Gallio was between 51 and 52 AD or BC, Grant? It was AD, right? 51, 52 AD? Okay. Corinth was 400,000. Okay, I was looking for population. So it grew. So if I'd found record of Corinth being about 90,000 and 400 BC. Other research says that it had grown to about 400,000 at the time of Christ. So you think about that from the standpoint of a lot of people in that little area, especially in that date and time. Let's see here. Now, Corinth on the map is current-day Corinth. That Archaea Corinthios is actually the ruins of what is now Corinth. So Corinth wasn't right on the sea. Corinth was back some. Let's see here. If it'll pop up. You can see the ruins throughout the area in here. Let's see. I don't know that it really matters. I had all this planned out anyway. All that to say, this area was extremely popular in location, in population, in commerce, in religions, nationalities, and all those sorts of things. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I'll do my best with what we've got going on, is the fact that as we look into the book of Corinth, we want to look at the influences that would be affecting the Corinthian brethren. So I want to look at a couple of things. I want to look at religions, and I want to look at maybe education, wisdom, and knowledge. These are going to be a couple of things that are going to permeate, you know, the brethren there. They're going to have to deal with it as they put on Christ. They're going to have to deal with these other religions. They're going to have to deal with this wisdom of man. So In the region, there were several religions going on. So one would be Judaism, obviously. There was a synagogue in Athens. There was a synagogue in Corinth. There was also temples. So let's see here. Bear with me. I'm just going to put dots on the map, but I think it's important to notice. All right, there were at least seven different temples within a few days of Corinth. Now, in Corinth itself, was a temple of Apollo. Also in Corinth, or right outside Corinth, was a temple to Aphrodite. A little further over in Nema, which is about right here, was a temple to Zeus. And down in Argos, there was a temple to Hera. You move further inland here, there was one to Aesculapius. You had one here near Athens was to Demeter. You had a temple in Athens, Parthenon, that was to Athena. And then further south, you had a temple to Poseidon. Now, to give you an idea of distance, Corinth to Athens is about 55 miles. It's just a three-day journey. Now, that's not that far, all things considered, back then. And so to be able to travel 3 days to be able to go to a temple, you're in and around a lot of people. If there's 400,000 people and you've got trade constantly in and out, you're going to have a lot of people in and around, and you're going to be dealing with these other religions. You're going to be dealing with idolatry. You're going to be dealing with this other type of worship. On top of that, especially seeing as you had the temple of Aphrodite in the area. Along with that worship came sexual immorality. There came this idea that you could sleep with temple prostitutes. And that was a form of worship, which is something that is going to be discussed in Corinth as well. All that to say, in and around this area, there are a ton of influences that we're going to notice or the Corinthians are trying to get away from, trying not to let take hold of themselves. Along with that, there were also cults. So you had this temple of Aphrodite. There were cults associated with that. There was also a cult called the Cult of Mysteries. This Cult of Mysteries, and tell me if this sounds familiar, they taught about the secret knowledge, magic, this idea of this secret religious attributes. There's not a ton to know about them, but there were several cults with the same kind of connotation. So if I'm talking about secret knowledge, I'm talking about special wisdom. What does that remind you of? Gnosticism. Now, again, I did some research. Best I can tell, Gnosticism popped up in and around the time of Christ, unless you know it's further. Anybody else know if it ventured further back? Do you have any research on that? Or? Okay. No, I just, it seemed like it kind of permeated that area in that time. The research I was doing on Gnosticism. Okay, so in and around the time of Christ, it was really gaining ground. Whether it be those who were trying to permeate the or infiltrate the Christians to pull them away, this idea of knowing something that everybody else didn't. Now we might have a few in here who haven't heard of what Gnosticism is. So I want to briefly discuss what that is. Gnosticism is a religious movement centered on a secret intuitive knowledge of spiritual truths, which was considered necessary for salvation. Two types of Gnosticism we generally discuss is ascetic Gnosticism and licentious Gnosticism. And they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. So you've got ascetic Gnosticism, so this secret knowledge, but this knowledge that talks about strict self-denial and detachment from the material world, rooted in the belief that the body and the created world are inherently evil. These would be the people who would punish their bodies, who thought their bodies were evil, that sort of thing. Then you have licentious Gnosticism that advocated unrestrained behavior, particularly sexual license based on a dualistic view of the spirit and the matter. So you have the spirit and you have the body. It doesn't matter what happened to the body as long as you kept the spirit pure. And so they would, with that type of Gnosticism, it didn't matter what they did with their body. So they would use it for whatever purposes they deemed necessary, which a lot of times was immorality. So along with that, the cults and the temple of Aphrodite, you've got these things that are permeating that area and those people during that time. Also, based on where Corinth is located, so close to Athens, you had a lot of education, a lot of people who claimed to be wise. You had philosophers, you had scribes, you had, and it mentions some of that in the first chapter. You had people who were knowledgeable. Flip over to Acts 17. What I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to set the table for this study with what Paul's going to be dealing with these Corinthian brethren. He doesn't necessarily come out and spell it out, but you see that you've got these ideologies that are kind of running through these brethren. You see that they're coming out of these types of ideologies, and he has to deal with them. In Acts 17, you see in verse 11, this is Berea. So this is north of Athens, up near Thessalonica. So in our other picture, imagine in Thessalonica, a little further over. You see it in a second. A little bit further south of Thessalonica, you've got Berea. And it says here that these Bereans were more noble-minded. You see that they received the word. They were with great eagerness examining the scriptures. Go down further, and then Paul moves into Athens. Now, when Paul moved into Athens, it says in verse 17, he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and God-fearing Gentiles. Alright, verse 18, it says also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers he was dealing with. He would talk to them. They called him an idol or babbler. He proclaimed her strange deities, but he was dealing with these who were supposedly the known men of the day, the knowledgeable men of the day. So you have where Paul is brought to the Areopagus, where they discussed religions and all these things, and he talks about this unknown God. They've got an idol to the unknown God. This area was thought to be known for free thinking, for wisdom, and that sort of stuff. Kind of like going to a college or going to a college campus, going somewhere where everybody thinks they know what's best. This idea that I've got the knowledge and you don't. I'm more noble-minded. And I say that noble-minded not from the standpoint of the Bereans were right. They were more noble-minded. I'm not saying that it's wrong to be noble-minded. But the idea of I'm higher educated, I know better than you. You know, they were the people of their day. Think of Aristotle and think of others, Galileo. And were they smart? Yeah. When it comes to this, no. And they weren't smart enough to see what was going on. Yes, sir. No, we should always strive to do what the Bible teaches, and our faith should be built on the evidences from the Bible. I'm setting the table, as I had mentioned. I'm setting up this idea of what the region is like, because we're going to get into 1 Corinthians, and we'll be in 1 Corinthians 1. So I'm just trying to give you an idea. We're going to get into 1 Corinthians 1. You're going to see that these Corinthians had put on Christ. They believed in the resurrection. They believed in the power of God. But Paul is having to remind them. There's factions. There's division. They're letting the wisdom of men overcome the knowledge of God. And so Paul in chapter 2, look over at 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Without getting into next week's lesson or next Sunday's lesson, you have Paul continually through the first 17 verses talking about Christ, constantly about Christ. And then he moves into 18 and on down. And in verse 18, he says, "For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing." But this foolishness is not actual foolishness, but it's foolishness as seen from the outside. "For the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved is the power of God." He's reminding them of what they've come to understand. "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of the age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world?" He goes on in chapter 2 in verse 4 and says, "My message and my preaching were not of persuasive words of wisdom, but in a demonstration of spirit and power." You've got all this going on, but Paul's trying to remind them in this context that I was there. It's not in words of wisdom. You saw the demonstration of power. Verse 5, "so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God." Yes, sir. He did. And, you know, it says here when he talks about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, In verse 22, it says, "For indeed Jews ask for a sign and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To Jews a stumbling block and the Gentiles foolishness." And it's interesting, these were the wise of the day, both in Judaism and other religions, and yet they were looking past what is right in front of their face, what is being performed in front of them with power, demonstrating that these things were true. Now, again, I'm trying to stay out of 1 Corinthians 1 because I'm not going to have anything to teach next Sunday. All right. So now, this is what's going on in and around the Corinthian brethren. Now, Corinth, Paul first came to Corinth in his second missionary journey. Again, we'll try this out. Okay. You can, that would be great. My maps aren't working. Okay. All right, that's fine. All right, so Grant will get the map set up in a second, but the idea I wanted to present here is that on Paul's second missionary journey in Acts chapter 16, so flip over to Acts chapter 16. We're just going to briefly touch on this because I want to get to more about Corinth. But in Acts chapter 16, you see Paul in 6 through 10 has come into Mysia, which is going to be the horn of Turkey. So imagine from your perspective, here's Turkey, here's the Aegean Sea, okay, and then here's Greece. All right, maybe he'll get it up. Hey, there he goes. All right, so he is coming into, I said Mysia. Okay, from there he hits Troas, and from there he then goes to Macedonia and Philippi. So there's something. I'm just going to keep dropping stuff. Okay, thank you. Y'all can see it. I think that's the biggest thing. So you see the Aegean Sea. You see that Paul on his, this is showing, let's see. That's just, this is the second missionary journey right here. Is it?
If you want to turn both of them are set.
Well, it's okay. Just leave it like that. That'll be fine. Okay. There we go. Okay. So, all right. So, Paul on his second missionary journey, he comes from Asia. He comes up to Troas. From Troas, he heads north. He comes up into Macedonia to Philippi. From Philippi, he hits Thessalonica in chapter 17, verse 1. From Thessalonica to Berea. And then he comes down to Athens. Now, we hear of churches being in Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea. Nothing in Athens. But outside of Athens, he moves over to Corinth. In Acts chapter 18, verse 1, this is when Paul first comes to Corinth. This would be in that 51 to 52 age time range based on the fact that Gallio was Corinth consul. And that's verse 12 of Acts 18. So Paul comes into Corinth. So he's there around this area. He comes on down. He meets Aquila and Priscilla. There. And then as he provides for himself, you go down to verse 7. You see that he left in there and went to the house of a man named Titus Justus, a worshiper of God, whose house was next to the synagogue. Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his household, and many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. Paul starts to preach. He's been preaching the night by to preach in verse 9, and then it says, now he's preaching and working. In verse 9 it says, "And the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, 'Do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city.'" So Paul's going to go out and he's going to preach a message. And God's going to be with him so that he's not attacked. If that is not ever present on your mind today, when you go out and you, in a country where we have freedom of speech, go out and want to proclaim what God would have us to do. For the right that you have as a citizen to be able to proclaim free speech and to not have to worry, to have the peace of mind that he's not going to worry about, you know, being persecuted. Well, I'm not saying persecuted, but he's not going to be hauled off. He's not going to be killed. I mean, we should be able to enjoy that now. Paul did it. He did get persecuted. He did get punished. But I mean, it is to me, what Paul was willing to endure and the fact that then he was able to go through with the mindset of, well, God is with me. God was always with him from the standpoint of this was the mission that he had given him. But Paul now has been told God is with him. Go through. Don't worry or be afraid any longer. Go and speak and do not be silent. And nobody's going to attack or harm him. And we know from other passages that Paul was attacked. He was beaten. He was imprisoned. There was a lot of different things that he had to deal with. It wasn't an easy road. He had to deal with both Jews and he had to deal with idol worship. He had to deal with fornication and immorality. He had to deal with these cults. He had to deal with all these things. But Paul spent time in Corinth in 51-52 A.D. on a second missionary journey. In verse 11, it said he settled there a year and remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria. So he's heading back towards Syria, all the way back over to end his second missionary journey. So Paul had been to Corinth. Now, this gives us an idea of when Paul had gone and visited that city. He converted both Jews. He converted Gentiles. He faced hostility. He faced a lot of different things. He had to deal with the morality in that society, idol worship and those sort of things. Went down to Jerusalem after the whole debate on circumcision. He wanted to go back and encourage after all that, that was the second missionary journey. On his third missionary journey, after he goes back to Antioch, verse 23 of Acts chapter 18, it says, having spent some time there, meaning Antioch, he left and passed through the Galatian region and then strengthened the disciples. And he wanted to head back through the region again. Now a Jew named Apollos, an Alexandrian by birth, he came to Ephesus, and Paul was going to be heading to Ephesus. You see that Apollos is preaching the baptism of John, that Priscilla and Aquila taught him better. And in Acts chapter 19, verse 1, it says, and it happened that while Apollos was at Corinth, Paul passed through the upper country and came to Ephesus and found some disciples. So you got Apollos, he'll become important in the very beginning of 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Paul goes to Ephesus and he's going to stay there a while. Paul reaches Ephesus about 54 AD, and we know that he stayed there for roughly, 3 years. In chapter 19, verse 8, he was there for 3 months. And you see verse 10, it says it took place for 2 years. You see that miracles and other things were being performed. You see that he eventually kind of gets run out of town. Now, right before he's run out of town is about the time that Paul wrote to the Corinthian brethren. He had received message and word from them. We'll look at that in a little bit from Chloe about reports of what was going on and then questions about stuff that was happening. But if you wanted to slide 1 Corinthians into Acts, this is where it would be. All right. So in verse 21, it says now after these things were finished, Paul purposed in the spirit to go to Jerusalem after he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, saying after I've been there, I must go to see Rome. So you see that he's in Ephesus, he gets run out of town, and then chapter 20, it says, after the uproar he had ceased, verse 1, Paul sent for the disciples when he had exhorted them and taken his leave of them, and he left to go to Macedonia. And so Macedonia is what? Philippi. Okay, when he had gone through those districts, he had given them much exhortation, and he came to Greece. This is the time frame in which Paul is visiting the Corinthian brethren again. He wrote a letter to them in the spring. He gets to Macedonia, to Philippi. He'd written them back. And then this is when he gets his second letter. Titus brings him. So look at 2 Corinthians chapter 7. Second Corinthians 7, verse 5, it says, for even when we came into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were afflicted on every side, conflicts without, fears within. Paul had written to the Corinthian brethren because of the reports and the questions. And he'd sent his letter with Titus. Titus comes back. He sends him back again. He's writing from Philippi, getting ready to come to them. In Second Corinthians, is written before he makes it there in Acts chapter 20. But he says in verse 6, "But God, who comforts the depressed, comforted us by the coming of Titus, not only by his coming, but also by the comfort with which he was comforted in you, as he reported to us your longing, your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced even more." So Titus brought a report back. And we talked about this in the first class, the idea that 1 Corinthians is an important letter to us because it covers so many doctrinal issues, but also how they responded. And so we have record of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, Paul writing to these brethren who are imperfect. And we see how they responded. And Paul was grateful for that. He mourned, but he was comforted by their response. Any questions, comments? I did want to cover, I missed this earlier. You know, when traveling, you know, Paul stayed in Acts chapter 20. He stayed with the Corinthian brethren for 3 months. To give you an idea of distance, you know, the distance between Thessalonica in this picture and Corinth is about 358 miles. So we could drive that in a day. It'd be a long day, but we could drive that. That's a 10 or 15 day journey. If you were to walk it, and I don't know if you would want to try to sail it or not because of the locations. It wasn't the quickest way to get back and forth. If you wanted to go from Corinth to Ephesus, because we read of that as well. Corinth to Ephesus is a 7 to 14 day sail, depending on the winds. It's not easy going. And Paul is trying to strengthen these brethren. He's far away, but he's not far away when it comes to this sort of stuff. But he is going through, and I think to take from this, the issues that they're dealing with, you know, we're lucky enough that we have so many places in that type of distance from us. And yet we can see them, get to them within a day's journey. To be encouraged, to be edified, to know that they're doing the same things we are. For that matter, you can grab your phone, you can FaceTime somebody. But that's not the case here. Paul was trying to go through and strengthen and encourage these brethren, and he took people with him as he did so. So that they knew that they weren't alone. So that they could help support others. We know that there was a collection taken up to go help the Jews in Jerusalem, the needy saints. It wasn't easy for them. I just want to express how grateful we should be for the fact that we don't have that type of journey. I'll be the first to complain sometimes when it takes 30, 40 minutes to get to work. You think about them having to go and travel to church. Not only walking, but through whatever kind of weather or the distances they might travel so they could assemble. And the fact that assembling would be a privilege. Think about that for Sunday Ayandari or some of those others. You know, to give you an idea of what they're dealing with. Also from the standpoint of understanding. Do I think it's okay to sin? No. Do I think it's easy to fall away in that time? Definitely. Because they weren't as close-knit as we are, able to encourage each other as much as we are. They have the resources at their fingertips, and they're being inundated constantly. Also, probably why God decided in his infinite wisdom to give them miracles to be able to confirm this word. It's different than Corinthian brethren is today. And so it's really important to understand what the Corinthian and the Corinthian brethren are dealing with in the influence or idol they're involved with. Think about that, 400,000 people. Most of them who are idle or dumb, that you don't know what you're talking about, that it's not, he's not the Christ, he hasn't arisen, you need to be doing this, you need to be doing that. Just these are the outside influences that the Corinthians are dealing with. Were they wicked people? They had been. But it's important to understand that, you know, we have the option to put on the new man. And it's important for us to understand that we're going to face struggles and trials. You should be able to read that. Paul didn't give up on this book and take comfort in the fact that we're not perfect, but we can strive to be. And that Paul didn't give up on them. Give up on one another. Questions or comments? Yes, sir. Sorry. I'm out of sorts. Sorry, give me a moment. I'm out of sorts with the way everything worked out this evening. Something else that was going on at this time. So I mentioned being able to help brethren out. Go look over at 1 Corinthians 16. No, I'm sorry. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now, we talked about this in the last class, that Corinth was made up primarily of Gentiles. There were some Jews there. We read about Crispus, and we read about the fact that there was a synagogue and people were baptized. But it was probably made up of Gentiles. Now, there was a collection that's mentioned in 1 Corinthians 16:1. It says, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia," there were needs in Jerusalem that needed to be met. Now, again, this idea of coming out of idolatry, you're also trying to get along with and deal with people who are opposed to you. You know, coming out of a situation where, you know, two people have been butting heads and all of a sudden you're supposed to love one another. You're going to be dealing with those types of issues. I think about segregation in the 50s and 60s. You know, people taught to be bigoted. You got Jews who are supposed to hate Gentiles. Gentiles who could care less about Jews. And, you know, they're trying to coexist now. And now you've got Paul who's going through this area and he's talking about this collection for the saints. And they're going to send this money all the way back to those in Jerusalem. Now, I've talked about it before, but, you know, the idea that there are people who are up in Illinois, Indiana, in Kentucky, Tennessee, in Alabama, in our state, knowing that there are other people who are working and worshiping, or for that matter, who are struggling. You know, this is what Paul was talking to them about. We can be encouraged by knowing that there are others who are dealing with the same things that we are. We can be encouraged by the fact that there are others who are working and worshiping and supporting and doing what God would have them to do. We can help them out in times of need. And that's what Paul is doing here. I wanted to mention that for the fact that look how far Paul had to travel. He goes through these different local works. He goes to Philippi. He goes to Corinth, collecting. He says right here he directed to all the churches of Galatia, which is in that Turkey area over there. Romans 15. Look at Romans 15 for a minute. Also talks about this collection. Paul, when he was going on these missionary journey, was not only encouraging these churches, but he was teaching them, especially in this. And he was being a servant to Christians as well. It says in start in 24. Whenever I go to Spain, for I hope to see you in passing and to be helped on my way there by you, when I have first enjoyed your company for a while, but now I'm going to Jerusalem serving the saints. From Macedonia and Achaia, I have been pleased to make a contribution for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. He's writing to the Roman brethren about, you know, this collection that he's taken up in Achaia and Macedonia. He's writing from Ephesus at this point. You know, he had to make a long journey. He was in Ephesus originally for 3 years. Now he's traveling back from Ephesus to go take this collection. Paul had been gone a long time. He's going to show the love and liberality of these other brothers and sisters. And it was a long and arduous journey. It's not as easy as it is today. So we should be thankful for that. 2 Corinthians, look over 2 Corinthians chapter 9 for a sec. Second Corinthians 8 and 9 talk about this collection as well. Chapter 8, verse 4, it says, "Begging with us, much urging for the favor of participating in the support of the saints." You see it again in chapter 9, verse 1. But in chapter 9, verse 12, it says, "For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings of God. Because of the proof given by this ministry, that will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all. While they also, by prayer on your behalf, yearn for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift." You know, this was a long journey. They were far, far away, but they had opportunity to help support. And when he talks about liberality in verse 13, it's an outpouring of love as much as it is money. You know, to be able to for the liberality of your contribution to them. This liberality, not only money, but it's the love and outpouring of a group of people who have hated you for so long. But it's important to understand that, you know, Paul had gone through and done this, and look how far he's got to travel. It's a long journey. All right, without being able to get on my iPad, I think I'm going to end it 2 minutes early, just from the standpoint of I can't get to my other material. Are there any other thoughts or questions before we end class this evening? All right, if not, then we'll end class early. Thank you.